Hi, it's Liz Dunchy, editor of thecorporatecouncil.net. Welcome to our podcast. I'm here today with Deborah Hicks Medanick, a corporate turnaround expert who over the years has served on the boards of 23 public and private companies and advised many others. Currently, Deborah runs Solon Group, which is an advisory firm she founded in 2005, and manages Prevail Investments, an investment fund she founded in 2008. She also serves on the board of the nonprofit Innovate Mississippi, as well as the Mississippi Seed Fund board and the board of the Biltmore. And the reason we're talking today is that Deborah has also recently published a book called The Governance Revolution, What Every Board Member Needs to Know Now, which is available at any of your favorite book retailers. I like this book because, along with a lot of practical tips, it describes the historical context that's influenced where we are today with corporate governance. And that's not only interesting to corporate governance nerds like myself, but it also gives some insight into some of the ambiguities that have come to light as the role of the board has evolved. And I think that helps directors and advisors understand what tools they have to address today's challenges and how they can use them more effectively to build long-term value. With all of the corporate failures and scandals that we keep seeing and the ongoing debate about short-termism, it's a really timely book. So, Deborah, thanks very much for talking with me today.
And thank you, Liz. What a beautiful summary of the reason the book is valuable. Thank you for doing it in a soundbite. It's great.
You can use that if you want.
Okay.
So it seems like you have a very full plate professionally and in your community. And I'm wondering what led you to take the time to write The Governance Revolution and share your experiences with the rest of us?
That's an excellent question, because sometimes I think I should have my head examined. But since I went on my first board in 1990, which was a highly controversial and embattled one, I have been absolutely fascinated by corporate governance. And as you say, the nerds looking at all the language in the bylaws and so on, mm-hmm. most people's eyes glaze over, whereas I am just absolutely riveted by these things. And as a turnaround person, what I have found is in case after case after case, a reason, and sometimes the reason, for corporate failure was simple issue of the board not understanding its responsibility. So when the opportunity to write the book dropped in my lap, I was thrilled. It did have a different title at the beginning, though.
What was that?
It was called The Art of Governance.
Okay.
Which is where I thought that I was going to write about sort of how to acquit oneself of the responsibilities of being a fiduciary, and that it is a gentle art that requires the use of the entire person to do it right. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a checklist. It's not one particular skill set. It's the whole person being engaged. And I thought that would be a very interesting thing to write. But halfway through it, I realized that I wasn't writing about anything that was an art. I was writing about war, that we are absolutely at war right now over the question of who controls corporate wealth, not just in this country, but as we are, you know, just about the biggest source of corporate wealth all over the globe. And who controls that wealth and who controls the setting of the future activities of the corporation? Is it the board of directors? Is it the shareholder and investor community? And increasingly of concern is it the regulatory and lawmaker community? So I was writing away on this, and it was only after it was finished that I had more proof of how timely it was, because we had Senator Warren with her initiative on what amounts to the social purpose of the corporation. We had California and its initiative coming from the legislature about pushing women as board members. And we've had a series of pretty high profile scandals that are underlining the same thing. Yeah. Who's in charge here?
Yes. Yeah, there's certainly a lot going on. And that's a really interesting way of looking at it. What would you say the most important messages are in the book?
Well, I love the fact that you picked up on the history, because as your basic, you know, liberal arts history major, when I started to write about this, I of course said, okay, well, where did it come from, this idea of the board and its responsibilities? And it was really interesting to dig into all of that and go back to 1597 and trace it forward. But I think fundamentally, the most important question is, who owns the public corporation? Mm-hmm. And in Europe, it's fairly well established. And there's an EU directive about this, confirmed in 2015, but first promulgated in 1948, that the shareholder of a public company does not own the corporation or a pro rata share of the corporation, that they have contractual rights similar to the rights of creditors. But they do not have anything more than the specific rights that are laid out in the charter and bylaws and certificate of incorporation. That is something that makes a great deal of sense to me. And yet in the United States, it's still a very controversial idea.
Yeah, I would say, especially with some of the case law that we have and some of the dicta even that's out there, and I'm still kind of wrapping my head around how that would play out too with the long-term value of the corporation and who's really in control of that.
You bet. And so look, let's look at it a different direction in terms of to whom is the board responsible? And, you know, the easy thing to say, since Jensen and Meckling promulgated this idea in the 1970s, is that they are responsible to the shareholders. But actually, if you look again at much of that case law and the black letter law, the board is responsible as a fiduciary to the corporation, not mm-hmm. to the shareholders. Mm-hmm. And it's through the corporation, through building a vital and profitable and sustainable corporation, that it serves shareholders' interests mm-hmm. by creating that value through the corporation. And here's the way it plays out in my head, which is that if we posit, as it has been popular to do in the last, 25 years, that the board is responsible to the shareholders, then the shareholders, and that what they're doing is trying to maximize shareholder value, because which shareholder and what value compared to what standard as far as maximizing goes is very, very murky.
Yes.
The easy way to feel that you are discharging your responsibility, alleged responsibility to maximize shareholder value, is to look at the stock price. So that brings all eyes to the stock price, which then does move toward this thing called short-termism mm-hmm. And make it difficult to think about how to build the sustainable enterprise over the long term and how to invest in product development and innovation and new ideas. So I would say that our system has been incredibly effective at fostering innovation and new ideas and new products. But it wasn't until the 1970s that this idea of maximizing shareholder value entered the language. Mm-hmm. So our history before that may have been what helped us along that curve of innovation.
Yeah, that's a good point. Very interesting. You mentioned that it's sort of a war zone out there, and that even influenced the title of your book. So when it comes to some of the hazards of the board process, I see that you talk about something called the state dinner. And what's that all about?
Well, let's think about how the board acquits itself of its work, right? It still follows the longstanding convention that it meets quarterly as the quarterly financial statement cycle sort of dictates. Right. And more companies have added more meetings and certainly committee meetings beyond that. But still, these meetings are infrequent. And the bonds between directors that are pretty much the majority of whom are independent directors who do not have a base of common history. So they're not well acquainted with each other except in the boardroom. What they end up doing is everybody is wanting to be sure that they are contributing that they are behaving in a way that is consistent with the high value and the respect and the decorum that goes with being a board member. So what they do, and even very long seasoned board members, walk into a new board setting, and what you do immediately is say, okay, I don't know which fork to use. Okay, let me look at how all the other people are conducting themselves, and I'll do just like they do so that I fit in.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And because the last thing that any director wants to be is an outlier.
Yeah.
If you're outside of the mores and behaviors of the group, you can't be heard. So you need to find a way that you fit in with the group, and then find a way that your voice is heard, which is a very complicated maneuver.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned earlier California's board diversity law, and there's been obviously a lot of push among investors and others to get more women and minorities on boards. And it sounds like what you're saying is even if we do get more diverse representation on boards, it won't necessarily have a positive impact if those people are still just trying really hard to fit in. So maybe there needs to be some other tool to prevent groupthink and help people have that collegial atmosphere where everybody feels comfortable in raising their valuable opinions.
Well, that's a multi-headed question, which is, if it was even a question, but which is really engaging because, it's very easy to say that corporate boards are, what is it, male, pale, and stale.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's generally more true than not, though less true with every passing year. However, why is that? And I do believe it's because the question of building trust on the board is really, really, really important. That the board is responsible for the future of the enterprise, and anybody on that board wants to have people that they trust sitting next to them as they are dealing with whatever they're dealing with. And it's a perfectly human thing to do to then say, okay, the easiest way to do that is to have somebody like me take the next seat. Right, because we really don't know how to think about evaluating people that are not like us. So I think that the value of diversity is significant. However, there's a precursor, which is how do we create an environment where trust and confidence are strong enough that we can afford to take the risk of bringing in someone who looks different from us.
Right.
Right? So that confidence and the fiber of the board is, I think, what has to exist. So while bringing in diverse members is very valuable, I'm sorry that it got to the point where the legislature felt it had to act in order to force it, because that in the short run will make it difficult to do it well.
Yeah.
It would be much better if it were demand pull. And if we talk about demand pull, I think we have all been accustomed to thinking about the idea of there aren't enough women on boards as if that is a women's issue. Shrill voices saying, include us, include us, include us, which I find actually kind of counterproductive and difficult because to me, that's not the fundamental argument from the point of view of the corporation and preserving its health, which is the board's job. To me, the argument is, what does nature tell us? Nature tells us that the best way to reduce risk and survive is to build an environment characterized by diversity. by diversification, by lots and lots of different inputs. That is what builds a robust organism. So I would not look at this as a women's issue at all. I would look at it in terms of corporate survival and how do we manage risk better? Well, we have to diversify the number of voices that are involved in considering the nature of the risk and how to protect the company.
Right.
You know, I like that argument a lot better than the women are 50% of the population and they should be 50% of the board, right? Because that is not about corporate health.
Yes. Yeah, right? I think we can all agree on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. What does the book say about bullying? It's kind of another one of the hazards, it sounded like.
Well, I'm interested that you've picked on my two favorite subjects in the book. The first one was the history, which I just found absolutely mesmerizing as I dug into it. And the second one, of course, is the group dynamics, in that, to me, there is relatively little focus on what makes a good board good. And there are a lot of good ones to look at. But one of the sort of rules of some of the good ones is that they foster disagreement. They foster open debate. They foster the board members' ability to really say what's on their minds. And then they foster a culture which then, once they leave the boardroom and they've had all these debates and these brawls and so on, they walk out comfortable that they've really examined the issue and made a decision that reflects all the voices, and they are unanimous. But if you don't encourage that kind of broad discussion, including every single voice in the room, and getting the benefit of the diversity you've put in the room, so that the women are not just trying to imitate the men and figure out what it takes to be a good board member and getting a pat on the head.
Right.
You know, instead, they're really having their voices heard. You have a different situation. And bullying is sort of a shorthand for the fact that it's very easy for someone who's been on the board for a long time, or for someone who is tall and male, or someone who simply has a particularly good grasp of language, or even of Robert's rules, to control what gets discussed in the boardroom. And if a question that appears to be going off script is raised, to simply say, that's really not appropriate for the board. Let's talk about that offline. Let's talk about that later, which in a way is a form of intimidation. The question is, who controls the agenda? Who lays out what is appropriate for the board to discuss? And how inclusive is that of all of the issues on the board members' minds?
Wow, that's a really interesting way of looking at that. It kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier about how being a director requires using your full person. And I guess especially if you're the chair and you're kind of trying to control or facilitate a good dynamic and also make sure the board's accomplishing what's on the agenda.
Well, I've been really impressed with a couple of podcasts or, you know, videos of Betsy Atkins, a longtime veteran director. And she had a couple of great suggestions for things like the executive session, where one thing she said to do in the executive session is for the chairman or the leader, whether it's, if it's an independent, lead director, to simply practice going around the room in the executive session and asking every single board member, okay, what went well? What did not go well? What do you want to see included in future meetings? Do you see any urgent issues, and so on? And making sure that each voice speaks up.
Mm-hmm.
And then what the leader does is assimilate that into, or as she said, anonymize it, and then convey that back to the CEO and the management team. And that, so the point of that is that I think there are some simple devices where if there is recognition that hearing every voice is important, that the leader of the board can organize to do it. But first you have to recognize that it's important and that the value of diverse opinions is great, that you're not trying to score people on how closely they correspond to the strongest voice in the room when they say something. You know, it's a fascinating dynamic.
Yeah.
The question of how you make the group dynamics in a boardroom work. And, you know, then there's the whole question of bias of who was that guy that I wrote about? I quoted him. Solomon Asch did that experiment that I think it's generally familiar to most, where, you know, you've got the six lines on the whiteboard or something and one line is shorter, and you ask all the people that are coming through, you know, are they all the same size? I mean, everybody else thinks they're the same length. Aren't they the same length, or are they the same length? And that basically a very high percentage of the people do not want to disagree with the norm. So they agree that, yeah, the lines are all the same length, even though it's perfectly obvious that one line is shorter.
Yeah.
And that desire to conform to perceived group norms is really powerful, especially in the boardroom where you feel like you've been given a great honor, a great respect. You fought really hard to get there in the first place, and you don't want to do anything to rock the boat. I, of course, am a veteran boat rocker. So
I couldn't tell. Oh, that's funny.
I'm nice, though. I'm friendly and kind.
Yeah, I think there have been so many social experiments like that where that's the result, but people sort of write that off as a soft skill or something that they don't need to pay attention to, or maybe they just don't think of it. And how it applies to the boardroom dynamic. So it's really it's really good that it's laid out in your book so that people can give more thought.
Well, I suppose there's a key point to this. I'm sorry for interrupting you, but the key point is that, and this is something that has struck me for decades, is that boards often are looking for, okay, we need somebody with that particular technical skill. We need somebody with that particular geographic market knowledge. We need this and that. But often what they also need is somebody who really understands the ins and outs of corporate governance. Because as you alluded to in your opening remarks, we do have an evolving understanding of what the role of the board is. A survey in the late 1960s of something like 1,500 corporate executives found that most of them felt that it would be a breach of fiduciary duty to focus only on the interests of shareholders. As time has gone by, we have the argument that the board is really there as the agent of the shareholders taking root, but the evolution over, I don't know what you'd call it, six decades of this different view of what the board is responsible for doing. It's not like everybody is reading the same book and coming up with the same understanding of what their job is. We have people who took on the job in the 70s who may understand it very differently from people who took on the job in the 90s, from people who took on the job in the aughts and the tens or the teens. In other words, they're overlapping understandings in the boardroom of what the job of the board is, which can have the effect of forcing the result toward the least common denominator. If we're confused, we do nothing.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I hadn't thought about that before, the different perspectives that people of different eras might have. What's been the biggest surprise for you in reaction to the book?
One thing I'll tell you is that I was actually fairly anxious that I was going out on a limb with this shareholder value thing, and the public company is not owned by shareholders. And what's been really interesting is the degree to which legal scholars have agreed with me. And I have found that I have been absolutely floored by the high quality, you know, the high office of the people that have gotten excited about this book, which makes me really do believe that the message is timely. You know, there's a lot of work being done right now about the purpose of the corporation and the purpose of the board. There is a project called The Purpose of the Corporation, which emanated out of the Czech Republic, but it was done, it's now had roundtables around the globe with many different players, and the writings that they have come up with on the purpose of the corporation are just gorgeous. And they reflect these roundtable discussions. Another way that attention is being focused on this issue is through the World Economic Forum in conjunction with a series of legal minds, most prominently, I believe, Marty Lipton of Wachtell Lipton, and they're writing about the new paradigm for corporate governance, which is positing something that I do not think at the end of the day is going to be practical, but it's positing the idea that if the corporation will undertake to do X, Y, and Z in terms of its governance practices, then the institutional investor community will undertake to do A, B, and C in response. And that will then have an alliance of interest between the large corporations and the large investors, which can be seen as a way to create a united front when the activist shareholder rears his ugly head. And the writing in The New Paradigm of Corporate Governance, which is largely, I think, penned by Marty Lipton and his team at Wachtell Lipton.
Yeah, we've posted quite a few of those of his memos to our site on that topic.
Yeah, they're beautiful, right? He's done a beautiful job writing on that. But, you know, what you have to remember in the world of the institutional investor, even if they have one CEO like Larry Fink, who's writing these exhortation letters, sometimes threatening letters, but that he's putting out every year, as if he is a single voice on behalf of all the dollars that are invested with him, you know, you have to realize that that's really not true, that these investors are no more able to be long-term thinkers, as in to sustain a quarter or two of sub-optimal performance, you know, than the companies are, because their investors, if they're in index funds or even in managed accounts, they are watching investment performance against benchmarks like an eagle, and they will move that money very quickly if they feel that they are not acquitting themselves of their fiduciary duty to get the highest return for their investors in turn. So the argument about the alliance with the institutional investor only goes so far in that the money is not necessarily stable and able to enter into any kind of covenant.
Well, definitely a very timely book, as we mentioned. I really enjoyed it.
Did you actually read it?
I read most of it, yeah.
I'm so glad. That's so cool, because I thought maybe you might have skimmed over it to prepare, but I'll tell you one other thing before we say goodbye is that, you know, like most sort of high-level corporate and financial people and so on, most of my life has been powered by anxiety. And it's been my great friend, and I've sort of been powered forward because I was afraid not to. But the truth is, when I sat down to write this book, other than worrying about getting, whoa, I'm way far out there in what I'm saying, I didn't have a moment of anxiety. It was pure pleasure to sit there and write this book and then to send it off to people, to send it off to Harvey Pitt and to send it off to Ira Milstein. And, you know, and I knew they were going to love it.
Wow.
And lo and behold, they loved it, and, which is not like me. You know, usually I'm motivated by fear. I'll take those actions anyway, but I'll be terrified of what they're going to
do. Isn't that funny how much better it feels when you're feeling confident and good about it?
So much better. So much better.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Deborah. This has been a really fun conversation.
Yes, indeed, Liz. Thank you so much. And I have to come up with another book to write so I get to talk to you again.
I agree.